Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Two very interesting guests for you today. Yesterday was a perfect day where I live to kick back with a mug of steaming cocoa and read a good story. And my first guest today is Rita Mae Brown. She's been described as a natural-born storyteller. Her new novel showcases her passion for all four-legged creatures and her respect for the environment. And Rita Mae Brown joins us in just one moment. Coming later in today's show, we'll explore a really controversial topic. It's risen to the surface again with the recent release of official reports from the British government, reports that were paralleled last month by US hearings reported in Reuters in the US. And I say it's controversial because some people believe it's a phenomenon that's man-made, a big fat hoax. Some people believe it's a phenomenon created by technologies, and others believe it's all down to universal forces outside of our own realm. So I don't know if you can guess what I'm talking about, but you'll have to stay tuned to find out. I'll be talking with producer-director Susan Taylor. She joins us later in the show to share what she's discovered about this phenomenon while filming. And she'll also be talking about her take on 2012. First of all, I'm very pleased to welcome Rita Mae Brown to the show. She's been described, as I said, as a natural-born storyteller. She's a tireless advocate for animals and the environment. She's been involved in politics. She's won Emmys in Hollywood. She's a polo player, a rancher, and described as a woman all around who defies conventions. She's New York Times best-selling author many times over, and her new book is called A Nose for Justice. It introduces Mags, a city girl struggling to create a new life after the Wall Street crash leaves her with nothing, and two new interesting sleuths. Rita Mae Brown, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks.
Well, I have to say, I enjoyed reading your website, too, because you are a natural-born storyteller. You say on the website, my entrance occurred on November 28th, 3 days after my birthday. The cats, hounds, and horses of the world rejoiced. The humans didn't give a damn.
I think it's probably still the same all these years later.
So you talk on there about your mom and your dad. Your mother sounds very interesting. Talk to us a little bit about her, if you would, and how she...
My mother was wild as a rat. Oh, my God. I mean, in our family, I'm known as the dull one. Because usually I would have to get mom out of her little scrapes. But you have to realize, in the South, you can do anything you want as long as you had good manners. And mother had impeccable manners. But I credit her for... taking me to the backside of tracks when I was young and teaching me about horses, and I learned to love them there, and hounds, and I mean foxhounds, and everything. And there, she could not pass up any creature in need, whether it was an animal or a human. And I wasn't the only stray in her house. I mean, there were cats, there were dogs, there were kids.
Oh.
And she said, well, I got a rubber tablecloth. It'll stretch to fit one more.
What a great philosophy. Great legacy to leave when people are like that, I think.
You know, I think so, too. I find people getting more and more perhaps disconnected and insular than they were when I was young.
Mm. I have one uncle that was very, seemed very staid and very, he liked routine. He cycled the same route for like 30 years going to work and back, and, you know, had little habits that he liked. But his philosophy was nobody in need will ever be turned away from our home. And even though by, you know, materialistic standards, they did not have a great deal of wealth, when he died, I thought what a fantastic legacy he had left to everyone around him.
You know, it's interesting. Lives are like novels. You don't really fully appreciate and understand them until you reach the end.
Mm.
You know, but I mean, you and I were both lucky to be around giving people, and I don't know if you have pets, but I'm sure many of your listeners do. And that's a love that never ends. They just give and give and give. And so often when people are in troubles, whether it's you know, their heart is breaking because of some romantic mess, or they've lost their money or their looks or whatever is important to them. You know, that animal's right there loving you, says, come on, we'll get through it.
Yeah, it's very true. It is true. I'm assuming this is why they're so prevalent in your novels, because you are such an animal advocate.
Well, you know, it isn't just that. We share this earth with so many sentient creatures. It surprises me that other writers don't include them in their novels. Everything is so human-centered, and our take on reality is not the only one. And in many ways, it's a very attenuated one, because our senses are so dull compared to these other creatures.
Mm. I think everything in life that we experience, when you are in a creative force, everything you've come across comes out in your writing in some level. You talk about your dad with great affection. You say he died, I think, when you were about 17. And I love this that you said about him. He worked from sunup until after sundown. His voice was so deep it could roll back the tide. What did you learn from your dad?
To just laugh. You know, let me put it this way. I think my dad's motto was, worse things have happened to nicer people. So whatever it is, just smile, just get through it. And when he died, there were hundreds of people at his funeral, and we didn't know who they were.
Mm.
And they were people he'd helped.
Mm.
Again, not a lot of money, but they had a meat market and a grocery store, and he would open the back at night and give to those, give day-old food, et cetera, to those that didn't have anything. And I didn't know my dad did that.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. You go through an academic career for some time, Rita Mae. Tell us a little bit about that. You made a statement that creative people do not belong in the university. What did you mean by that?
You know, I do mean that. The university is a left-brain place, where everything is logical, needs to be proven, and the passive voice is the ideal voice in which to cover your mistakes. So that's the voice of government, and all too often, all academic papers are written in this dreary, dull, passive voice, which hides the agent of action.
Mm.
You know, it's really a tricky little grammatical thing there. To be creative, you have to use your right brain. You shouldn't need to prove anything. You should never need to explain a story. The story just is there. You know, either the reader gets it, responds to it, or they don't. If you have to explain what you mean, you failed. The university is always telling you to explain. That's why writing departments, in English departments, there's always an uneasy truce between the two.
Mm. So tell us what took you to Hollywood. Your story itself is really interesting. What took you off to Hollywood?
Norman Lear. It called me up and said, I've got this show I want to do. Will you come out and help me? Now, I didn't know Norman from a hot rock, and he didn't know me either, but he read my work and liked it. I mean, I knew who he was. And I went out and worked on a two-hour variety show with him called I Love Liberty, and that was my first Emmy nomination. And I discovered that I could write movies of the week for Hollywood. It was really not that hard, to tell you the truth.
Right.
And I liked it up to a point, but when I started realizing, you know, you'd go to a gathering, or it should be a social gathering, and people were all talking about the deal instead of the content of the film that was to be written, I didn't belong there. So I left. But I didn't leave with anger or anything like that. I just knew if I stay here, I will destroy whatever creativity I have.
Yeah. And so how long were you there about?
I was there about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then I would still do stuff from home. I mean, I would still do some movies of the week. But then finally, I just stopped. And there are two reasons. One is, once you reach 40, you're considered ancient. And producers swear there's no age bias, but of course there is.
Right.
In fact, now there's a class action suit through the Writers Guild of America on just that subject. So I got less calls. I still got some. But also, violence began to be so... Everything was violent. Everything was film noir. You know, it was dark. You couldn't even see what was happening on the screen. We're a little bit past that now. I'm not saying I'm against violence as part of life, but I don't want gratuitous violence.
Right, right.
I just didn't want to do it.
Yeah. So when did you first start writing, Rita Mae? How old were you? I think I remember reading somewhere that you were very young.
I was five.
Yeah, that's what I thought. As soon as you got your library card right at the age of five.
I did. And they didn't want to give it to me. So my mother made me stand on a chair and read Little Women out loud to the librarian. Softly, but out loud.
Right.
And that's how I got my library card.
And then, so where did it go from there? Did you started writing at school, and how did you come across your first novel?
Well, I started doing plays at school, you know, because once a year there's always some little thing each class has to do. And I would always be the one tapped to do the plays. And I found out, oh, this is kind of easy for me, and I really like it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did my first novel, I think I was 24. And I guess I just did it because I was too dumb to know it's supposed to be difficult. You know, and I had Greek and Latin, and I thought, nothing will be harder than Attic Greek. Nothing will be harder than reading Aeschylus, Sophocles, all of those guys in Attic Greek. And you know what? I was right. It's not as hard as that.
Yeah, I always say there's something to be said for naivete. You know, we just have this blind vision of what we can do and don't even put any obstacles in our way.
Well, I'm still that way. Obviously, I haven't learned a thing.
Oh, I think you have. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk about A Nose for Justice, which is Rita Mae Brown's latest novel, and she's introducing two new sleuths in this section. If you have questions, you can email them to me at live at conversationslive.net, live@conversationslive.net, and we'll read those out on the air and get those answered for you. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Rita Mae Brown. Please stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. There's no better time than right now to enjoy your life, to experience it as an exciting journey of discovery. You don't have to wait for perfect. Nothing externally needs to happen. It's simply an internal shift of consciousness. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific time for Dancing on the River with Mark Suznow, right here on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
1150 KKNW.com. Your connection to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Paperback writer. Paperback writer.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. I'm talking in this segment with New York Times bestselling author and Emmy Award winner Rita Mae Brown. Her new book is called A Nose for Justice. Rita Mae, you've written many books about animals that include animals, as you said in the beginning of the show. You had a series with Mrs. Murphy the Cat, and now your new series includes two dogs, Baxter and King. Tell us a little bit about the new book. It came out a couple of weeks ago. Tell us a little bit about your new characters in this new series.
I'm delighted to. But first, Sneaky Pie, the cat books, they're out in the spring. She'll be horrified if I don't give her a plug.
There you go.
The egotistical little twit. But this book was published on September 20th, and I've been very surprised at people's response to it. It's set in Nevada, which is, as you know, a barren and underused state in our country. People don't seem to have as much interest in it as I certainly developed. But it starts with a little dog, a wire-haired dachshund. and his master, who's this beautiful 34-year-old woman who's a Wall Street trader, has lost everything. And as we say down south, she comes home by weeping cross. I mean, she's defeated, she's ruined, you name it. And so her great aunt has a ranch in outside of Reno, Nevada. And she says, look, I'm not going to pay you, but I'll give you a roof over your head and you'll have food to eat. But you got to find your way in this life. So she comes to her great aunt's with her little dog. Well, her little dog doesn't know anything about the country. And, of course, her great aunt has a shepherd mix. So some of the fun of the book is the city dog and the country dog, you know, trying to learn to appreciate one another. And the older lady, and I will take just a minute on this, but mm-hmm. I am so fascinated and grateful to these women. She was a WASP, the Women's Auxiliary Service pilot, the women that flew the huge planes and the P-47s, the fighter planes, to bases all over the United States, where the men would then pick them up and fly them over the ocean, or our Russian allies would come over from Siberia and fly them back to the Russian front. They've never been recognized as a military unit. They've never even been able to shop at the PX or gotten any benefits whatsoever, but they did it. There were about 3,000 of them. There's 200 left. 38 died in service. The best they ever got was about 5 months ago, a ceremony in Washington in Congress thanking them for what they did. But they never really got a damn thing.
Wow.
And one of the women was interviewed. In fact, there's two survivors outside of Reno. And by the way, these women wore their uniforms, a lot of them. They looked good. I mean, these girls are in their 80s, and I tell you what, they looked good.
Oh, they must have been tough women, spunky women.
Yeah, I mean, I saw some pictures of them and all that. Thought, my God. And there's one an hour away from where I live. But this one woman was so touching. She was asked, why did you do it? You know, you didn't get anything. And she said, we did it because we loved our country.
Mm.
I thought, oh, my God, you know, I want somebody like that in this book.
And you got her. I mean, this was an amazing character, I think. You call her Aunt Jeep. Her real name's Magdalena, right? Magdalena. And they call her Aunt Jeep because she drives a Jeep. But I was thinking when I was reading that book, I'd love an aunt like that.
I know. She does what she wants. I mean, she's not unkind, but you know where you stand with her.
Yeah. Now, I know you're a rancher, Rita May, and you have a 600-acre ranch, I read. You are a working farmer, so you're very aware of environmental issues and what goes on as far as water rights and everything. And the whole premise of this book is based around the fight for water rights. So what made you choose that as the central point of your book?
Well, this is certainly not true of the state of Washington, but you get on the other side of those mountains in your beautiful state, and the history of the West is the history of water. Twain said, you know, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. And I didn't really realize it until I began to spend time in Nevada. I mean, even when I worked in L.A., I didn't pay any attention to it. I saw Chinatown. It was a great movie, but I still didn't pay attention to it. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And once I got out there and I realized, well, there's 7 inches annual rainfall in Nevada. There's now 2 million people in Las Vegas. How can they support these people without totally consuming the environment and destroying it for other forms of life, including, ultimately, their own?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, if we keep growing at the rate we're growing, we can't stop this destruction. And so this book is about, you know, a small crisis involving water rights, but it illustrates the larger issue. And, I mean, there are some things we have to think about in the future, particularly in the West, that are not congenial to Americans, such as limits. You know, Americans never want to hear about a limit.
That's true.
but we're going to have to face them.
Yeah.
And if we do it now, it won't be a crisis later.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it is about our people. I mean, I'm an American. I love us. But we wait until it's such a terrible mess. And then we rise to the occasion. We're really quite magnificent. But we never plan.
Well, hopefully this is going to start a dialogue. The novel is fun. So hopefully it's going to start the dialogue in a fun kind of way.
Well, I hope so, too. But, I suppose if people behaved reasonably, I'd have nothing to write about.
This is true. I read years ago, Nora Ephron went screened into a house when she was younger. And, of course, she's a screenwriter, Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle and a whole bunch of other stuff. But she went into her kitchen where her mother was and was crying hysterically because her boyfriend had dumped her. And Nora Ephron's parents were both screenwriters, and in those days it was quite unusual for a woman to be a screenwriter. So she was quite well known, I guess. Maybe you know that more than I do. And her mother turned around to her and said, when she's crying hysterically about this boyfriend who's broken her heart, she goes, "Never mind, darling, it will make good copy one day." And so I told that to my mother, and because, you know, I write too, she said to me once when I was talking, she goes, "Never mind, darling, it will make good copy one day."
But, you know, maybe I should get that tattooed somewhere on my body. You too.
Yeah, really. So, why you got Aunt Jeep, you've got Mags, who's the Wall Street recovery, escapee, if you like. Very strong women in their own ways. And I know earlier on you were active in the feminist movement. You got into politics in some way. Are any of these characters resemblant of you?
No. I mean, if there's any character that resembles me, it's usually one of the animals.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
The women are all much prettier and nicer than I am, you know. But I'm fascinated with women's lives, and it's not that I'm not fascinated with men's lives, but they're so much better recorded, and they're always presented to us as being the central life. And so all I've done is, in essence, is take the circle and move 15 degrees in another direction. And so my focus is a bit more on the women. I hope I'm not unfair to men's internal lives. I mean, I think particularly the young policeman in this book, I think I'm pretty, I think I have some insight into his struggles. But what's happening, too, is the way we've changed, not just our opportunities from Aunt Jeep's generation, a woman born in the late 20s, to where we are now, but it's our outlook has changed. Our expectations of life are so different. Mm. And if you have a daughter, her expectations are going to be different than yours because the doors are opening ever and ever wider for women, which is a good thing because before, my God, I mean, there were women dying in their efficiently lit kitchens, you know?
Right, right. I actually was chatting with my mother about this this book, and she said that she was talking about that she'd actually coincidentally been watching a history program, which is how this subject came up in the beginning, because she was saying how just what you said at the beginning, that how active women were in the Second World War and how they just weren't acknowledged. And then she went on to, you know, personal things like, "I always wished when I was growing up I could wear a full-length pair of trousers because you weren't allowed to wear trousers in those days." And I thought, gosh, we really have changed in quite a short period of time.
Yeah, we have. I mean, and it's wonderful in many ways. You never want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, to use that old phrase. And I think most women have been pretty... but not pretty, but highly intelligent about not losing their soul, not becoming imitation men, so to speak.
Right, right.
You know, retaining what it is about being a woman that they love, but going out and gaining these very sophisticated skills. The women have always worked. I mean, poor women have always worked. Our idea of what a woman is, I mean, let me back up a minute. If you look at windows in stained glass churches, and I'm sure you've been to Europe and you've seen them,
mm-hmm.
who are the figures in those stained glass windows that were done in 800 A.D. or 1400 A.D.? Well, they're all wealthy women. So our idea of what a woman is always based on, you know, a queen, a duchess, or a rich woman. And it's only now that we're even beginning to look at the lives that weren't those lives, the lives of the poor women. And to me, it's a really exciting time, and it's an exciting time to be a novelist because nothing is denied you in terms of subject matter.
That's absolutely true. So let's go back to the book for a second. And you've got these two dogs who participate in the sleuthing. And I just had a listener question come in. It says, "I'm a huge fan of your work. Do you draw the illustrations in your book? You don't see many adult books with pictures in, but when I get a new book, that's what I look for first.
What a wonderful question. I do not. The illustrator in this book is somebody I worked with for the first time, a Miss Maestro, and the Sneaky Pies are a man called Michael Galately. When I was a kid, even you know, any novel, pretty much, had some illustrations in them. And when I started with Bantam, with this series, not with my standalones, I said, I won't do it unless we put illustrations in it. Well, they didn't want to do it, of course, so I had to agree to pay half. Once I agreed to pay half, they did it. And that's the deal today. I still pay half.
Oh, do you really?
I just think they're so wonderful.
Well, I have to confess, I flicked through and looked at all the pictures, too, once I realized there were pictures in there. So I'm sure a lot of people do.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like when, you know, there's photographs, you know.
Yeah.
Like there was a big book out about the Queen Mother.
Yeah.
Which, I, of course, I read word for word. Well, the first thing I went to was looking at the photographs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing with pictures. It just makes it more exciting.
Yeah. Now, Baxter and King are the two sleuths we just talked about. So why a wirehead dachshund and why a German shepherd?
Because one is a hound and the other is essentially a herding dog, and they have two different minds, really. A hound is, and it's a scent hound, not a sight hound. In other words, it lives by its nose. I mean, if a foxhound or a dachshund saw its quarry, it might not do a thing about it. But if it smells it, it will pursue it. So they're very determined. Once they get the scent, they stick to it. And dachshunds in particular are very brave dogs. People see them as cute, but they're way beyond cute. I mean, they'll go in a den after a badger, and a badger's a powerful animal.
Yeah, they're tough.
They're incredibly tough. And a shepherd, it's not that they're not tough, but they're bred to herd. They're bred to work on top of the ground, so to speak, in cooperation with a human, and to be very alert. They're just two different canine minds, and they fascinate me. So that and the fact that one's a city dog and one's a country dog is fun for me.
Yeah. I can, and the voice, I mean, you captured what we think their voice is going to sound like. You captured it perfectly. I want to ask you about this because you are a passionate animal advocate. I mentioned earlier, you know, you're a rancher, you were a polo player. You love fox hunting. Talk to me about that. And, you know, how does, you said in an article I read that fox hunting, you believe it promotes animal welfare. How so?
Oh, I think it very much, particularly in the United States. Americans chase, they don't kill. Our farming practices are very different than the English. I certainly don't want to present the English as brutes. But also, our land masses aren't as, I mean, you know, England has been identifiable as a country since Claudius got there in, what, 69 AD or BC,
right,
or what, somewhere, no, it was
right,
AD. And I guess Caesar was there before that. So it's very, very settled. Here, it's wild, and the fox can get away from you. I mean, I couldn't get one if I wanted to. And they're so smart, they can process information much more quickly than we can.
Mm.
But when you're out there and you're astride a large prey animal, you are a medium-sized predator, you're working very closely with another predator who's a bit smaller than you, that being the foxhound. When you see how all of us work together, and then you see all the other things, the birds, the fox, the foxes get, you know, what the fox's prey is, the plants, you know, how a fox will use a plant to spoil its scent. It is just thrilling. And you can't look at this and not want to preserve it for children and grandchildren and all that. You don't want it to become developed and poured over with concrete.
That's very true. I got caught up once when I was at home in England. I got caught up in the middle of a big protest about fox hunting because the hunt was out, and they came across all these protesters. We just went out for a quiet picnic, but we got caught up in the middle of all this mayhem. I've been on a mock hunt where they lay an aniseed trail for dogs, and the dogs love to work that aniseed trail, and you get the same kind of thrill, I think. But
oh, it's wonderful. And to hear their voices, to me, that's like Bach.
Yeah, yeah.
But one quick little aside, I know you can't answer this, but you're probably aware of it. As an American, I was stunned. I've always assumed that the English were smarter than we are, you know, in so many ways, because the parliamentary system alone is superior to a two-party system in so many ways. And when I discovered, because we kept getting the news here, that under Tony Blair, Parliament debated for 800 hours whether to stop fox hunting or to make it illegal, and only 4 hours whether to send men and women to their deaths in Iraq. I was stunned.
Well, I can't answer that. You're right.
Yeah. It's just like, what in God's name has happened? Where's the sense of perspective?
Yeah, I hear you on that.
I mean, it isn't that there aren't people here that can get sidetracked, obviously. We can. But, oh, my gosh, and these emotive issues, you know, I mean, I don't care whether it's abortion or gay marriage, or all, they get your eye off the real function of government and the economy. What good are those rights if you can't eat?
That's very true.
I mean, again, but you're talking to a farmer. I'm real basic.
Right, right.
To me, it's food, clothing, and shelter. Anything after that is gravy.
Well, I remember reading, let me find the quote here. You'd say, you do have moments when a flicker of vanity hits me and I think, damn, I need a facelift. But I remind myself that there's a starving hound someone has abandoned. I must catch it, feed it, and restore its confidence in the hound-human bond. So what if I look like hell? My heart is full, and I wish the same for you. I loved that.
Thank you.
What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Oh, Ms. St. Clair, thank you for asking me that. I would beg your listeners to go to the SPCA and to bring an animal home if you can. If you can't, leave them $10. Just help out.
I thank you for being with us. And people can find out more about you at ritamaybrown.com. That's correct, isn't it?
It probably is. I don't have a computer. I just send it into somebody that puts it up.
Oh, well, that's pretty cool.
I know it is.
Let me find my notes here and I'll make sure. Yes, it's ritamaybrown.com, and May is M-A-E, ritamaybrown.com. They can find out more about you and your books right there. Thank you, Rita Mae Brown, for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, ma'am.
And please stay with us when we come back. We'll be joined by producer and director Suzanne Taylor. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Fox in the snow, where do you go to find something you could eat? 'Cause the word out on the street is you are starving. Don't let yourself go hungry now. Don't let yourself go cold.
If you missed the show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
For the people, by the people. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Circle out, but they don't say pharmacy, ranch out west. Circle out, now it's circle out. They grow their greens, they say they grow their fruit. Circle out, well, buy a bamboo fence on a rural route. Circle out, all naked in the sun. They got a suntan.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And as I said, as I promised you, two very interesting women joining us today. My second guest is Suzanne Taylor. Before I move forward, I want to thank Beth for sending in that question that I answered off email. I forgot to say that. But if you'd like to send questions or comments on this segment of the show, you can send them to info@conversationslive.net or live@conversationslive.net. They'll both get to me. All right. So my next guest is Suzanne Taylor. She's the producer and director of What on Earth? Inside the Crop Circle Mystery. She's been involved with film since she graduated from NYU. She was originally an actress and crossed over to the other side of the camera as executive producer of the feature documentary Crop Circles, A Quest for Truth. Suzanne Taylor, welcome. Welcome.
Hello, happy to be here. Love to be talking about this subject.
Well, I came across your film, about a year ago. And then it came back to me a couple of weeks ago, and I rewatched it this morning when I was getting ready for the show, so because I wanted it fresh in my mind. And I have to say, if you're going to make a film about crop circles, this was really well done.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, a lot of people think it's the best film that's ever been made about them, and that makes me very happy.
Well, I'm sure. Now, let's start at the beginning here, because so many people, I was a skeptic. I don't know what to make of them. I'm going to be really honest. I'll just put
well,
that right
well,
out
really,
there.
You know, no, you have to be a skeptic. Nobody wants you not to be a skeptic. You know, but not to be a dyed-in-the-wool skeptic the way these committed skeptics are, where without even looking at evidence, they're skeptics, yeah. You know, or they're disbelievers, actually.
Well, I was going to say a few years, many years ago, actually, 20-some years ago, I actually went to see a crop circle because my former husband was really into all this stuff and UFOs and all that good stuff. And so I went down with him for the weekend to Warminster, which is in Wiltshire, the Wiltshire area where your documentary film was made.
Right.
And it's an area where the most magnetic lines cross in England. And so there are always reported sightings and all kinds of, you know, stuff happening down there.
Yeah, it's a hot spot.
Yeah. And so there was a crop circle that had come up and we drove down that weekend to take a look at it. And I'm like, what a waste. Oh, well, at least we're going away for the weekend. He's all excited. I have to tell you, when I got there and saw it, I could not figure out how anybody could have made that circle.
I know. You stare at these things in awe, but in truth, probably nobody did, although we have to confess the hoaxers have gotten better at it. Although they, you know, we have a real phenomenon and then we have our fakes, but the fakers used to be very obvious. They were so messy that, you know, you just didn't have any conflict in your mind. You just knew. But now you have to work at it. You have to kind of look at the evidence to examine which is which. And I don't know how they've gotten as good as they've gotten, to be honest with you, but they still aren't as good as the real thing.
Mm. Well, you say you're not a filmmaker who found a subject. You're a subject who became a filmmaker.
Exactly. I've been plugged into this phenomenon since the late 80s. And at some point, I just made a vow that if there was anything important I could do with my life that, you know, hardly anybody else could do, since I have this kind of feeling of outreach and connecting to the world, that I was going to be the spokesperson that got the world to pay attention to crop circles. And I've been, you know, on that mission for some years now. That was in the mid-90s that I took it on that way.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You say, people in the film, you talked with people who claimed that they had faked the crop circles, or some of them. They couldn't possibly have done all of them because they are worldwide. You talked with people who believed the crop circles are here as a message trying to teach us the power to transform the world. I was never very clear in the film. And I think you probably did this intentionally because you did not interject your voice on the film. Talking to you now, you wholeheartedly agree. What? Where did these crop circles come from?
Well, indeed, you can't, as the filmmaker, make your speech. You really have to take what your interviewees say to you. And sometimes you go, oh, I wish they'd have said such and such the way I would have said it, you know. But you have to take it the way they've said it. So there are some things that don't get said. And this is the opportunity when we, us filmmakers, go out on the speaking circuit, we can clarify what our voice would have said and, you know, what is not so didactic as a kind of a, you know, instruction in the film. Well, the answer to the question of who's making them, however, is not something that I do have an opinion. I have an opinion about why they're coming. And and we can only have a conjecture. All we have is this beautiful evidence in the fields, and then we speculate, well, why is it there, and who's making them, and whatever. Well, the who's making them is an easy thing to answer, which is we don't know. And until they tell, they're visiting us, we're not visiting them. They have some superior technology. We're not drawing pictures on other planets. So until they identify themselves, we just have to say, not us. You know, who's making them? Not us. But in terms of why they're here, I believe there. And by the way, I have a little file called "Other People's Interpretations," and they're wild. I mean, incredibly fanciful. We could do a whole radio show about the fanciful ideas
right,
people have,
right.
Including artists on not artists, but who makes graffiti? Bad people making graffiti on our planet. That's, you know, they got a better technology than we do, and they're making graffiti here. But of course, it's beautiful graffiti. Then again, some graffiti on our planet is quite beautiful, also. So anyway, that's one opinion. But my opinion about why we are getting these gorgeous formations is to make us aware of the fact that there's other intelligence in the universe, because that would change us radically. And, you know, I think we're in a sweet universe, and I think perhaps the superior intelligences are watching out for the lesser evolved peoples, and that... there also, I would speculate, is some kind of non-intervention, you know, prime directive from Star Trek, you can't go and save another planet. Well, that seems to go way back into other kinds of sacred literature and what have you. So, you know, they can't come here and fix it exactly, but what they can indicate, what they can give us is some kind of... tools. Ammunition is a bad word. It's a war word, and one of the things I can't understand is why we make war. But that's a whole other topic. But they're giving us the material with which to understand that we are not alone. And if we understood that, we would become one humanity, talking to one another, figuring out what's going on. We would be one humanity in relation to the other. Right now, there is no other. There's just us, and here we are turned on one another, doing all these violent things and raping our planet, blah, blah, blah. But if we were part of a much larger system, our minds would be open to the otherness, and we would be one thing in relation to something so much vaster that you can just picture the beauty of it all, that we're now not small-minded, we're big-minded. And, you know, we need to open ourselves to a larger perspective in which we really become a more enlightened species. And I think the awareness of other intelligence would be a huge aid to having that happen. The last time we had such a big leap was when Galileo and Copernicus took Earth out of the center of the universe, the sort of arrogance we had about we are the central planet and, you know, the universe revolves around us.
Right,
we had
right,
kings
right.
and serfs at that time. It kind of fit that kind of mentality. Well, this would be a next step to reduce our arrogance and take us out of that superiority in which we act so arrogantly, you know?
Okay. We need to take a quick break, Suzanne. So I'm going to ask you, I have a couple questions I want to ask you when
Most
we come back.
Most of my
back.
Answers are not as long as that one, by the way.
That's okay. We're going to take a quick break. We'll
okay.
be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Let's play 10 questions. What is new at KKNW?
Real estate radio.
What's the show about?
Real estate? Actually, Val, we focus on buying, selling, owning, and financing residential real estate.
That's right, at the ground level, where most of us live.
Who are you guys?
Well, I'm Rob Gray, a broker for John L. Scott in West Seattle.
And I'm Craig Goble with Cascade Pacific Mortgage.
We're both active real estate professionals, and we're in the trenches every day.
Don't miss Real Estate Radio at its new time, 2 o'clock every Thursday here on Alternative Talk 1150. Intuitive Dream Coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking in this segment with Suzanne Taylor. She's producer and director of What on Earth? There's another bit to that. Here we are. What on Earth? Inside the Crop Circle Mystery. Her film has won several awards. It's been claimed as the best documentary on crop circles ever made. Why talk about crop circles today? Well, it leads to a much bigger subject. I know, Suzanne, you're very passionate about the upcoming 2012 and all the work that you say is coming in around that. But let's just talk about the film a little bit more here first. As early as the early 1700s, or I think you said 1678
is when the first ones. In the lore start date for when we can identify clearly that we were dealing that a crop circle phenomenon was here. There was a woodcut in the literature of the time, and it's unmistakably a crop circle, and it's a little dialogue between the farmer and mower or harvester, and he doesn't want to pay the money, and the harvester says, let the devil do it, and the picture is of clearly a crop circle with a little devil in it, and it's just unmistakable in 1678. And then about every 100 years, we had little flurries in the literature of the day that were clearly talking about crop circles. They didn't get named until the modern era. But
well, they were named fairy rings, as far as I remember from
well,
the film.
Well, that was another
that
name for them early on. And but, you know, you just look for what they're talking about, and you can say, oh, yeah, that has to be crop circles. We do a little recreation in our film of something from Nature magazine, the big serious science publication in England that was 1880. And they were, again, talking crop circles. But the circles seem to reward interest. And when interest wanes, they don't deliver anymore. And each of those times when a little bit of public interest was, you know, stirred up, it went away, and so did the circles. And it's only the modern era that interest kept up, and more people became interested. And now we have our full-blown phenomenon that doesn't go away.
And it was interesting in the film you said that it's less, people are less interested in America, even though they've had them in Ohio and other areas, because the circles go worldwide. And we call them crop circles still, but I mean, they're very elaborate now.
Oh, yes. It's one of the sort of, you know, this phenomenon seems to have a wink about it when you try to sort of catch it or pin it down or other kinds of things. It winks at you in some funny way. So the moment it got named crop circles, literally, and they had all been circular before that or combinations of circles, nothing but a circular shape. The minute they got called crop circles, we had our first straight line. And ever since, we've had different kinds of shapes, but the name has stuck because they had an institute. The Center for Crop Circle Studies was the institute that got created around this name, so it got solidified. Mm-hmm. But then we started to get all kinds of other shapes, but we still got our name.
Yeah, when you were going around asking people what they thought they meant, why are they doing this? The consensus from many was, you know, they're trying to teach us something. They're trying to, as you said earlier, trying to open up our mind to a new way of thinking, trying to get us to realize that there's more to reality than we think and know. I was interested, one of the fellows said that it's the other side trying to communicate. The Hopi Indians said they see those as warning signs that we're out of sync with natural life, with natural processes.
Well, their individual formations, we could call them, have a lot of information, content specific to that formation. It's just that when you try to put them all together, people say, well, it's like a jigsaw puzzle, they think. If the last piece drops in, we'll get the message. I don't think so. I think they're just, as I said, indicating there's other intelligence bombarding us. And then the individual formations, there's lots of stuff that you can discern from the good ones. And that was what the Hopis were reading. They were taken several images, and they looked at those particular images, and they saw in those images what they perceived to be warning signs comparable to the kinds of imagery that they were using.
Right. We have to talk about Doug and Dave.
Dear Doug and Dave. People still talk about it. You go down, you bring up crop circles. Oh, didn't those two guys, Doug and Dave, then sometimes they forget their names, but somehow they're indelibly etched. You say, do you mean Doug and, oh, yeah, those two guys. Yeah, they made them all. It's all over. That was 1991 that bogus report came out. And went in a press release that went out worldwide and made front pages, because before that there was lots of interest in the phenomenon. And the front pages of newspapers all over were running this story. Oh, hoax, revealed, crop circles are not real, these two guys made them all. A press release? Two little farmers from nowhere sent a press release all over the world? Well, we do a big number on that in the movie, where it seems to be that the Ministry of Defense in England was responsible for that press release. And for whatever, the powers that be don't seem to want us to really know about otherness. It happens with the UFO phenomenon. It happens with the crop circles. They seem to want to put us off the scent, And that was very effective, because I think, it's very challenging to have something so impossible be real, and people's minds get boggled, and, we don't like our minds boggled. Even at some level, we do. We like it in science fiction. But when it gets to be real, and it will really change our life and our world, that gets a little scary. So if we have a place to go, oh, yeah, we don't have to think about that anymore, that got solved, the mind seems to want to do that. We talk about that in the movie also.
A lot of people said, they seemed very credible. A lot of people said their cameras would not work in the circles, their telephones would not work in the circles.
This
and
is
yet,
absolutely
when you
true.
Stepped
equipment
right outside, they
all
did.
All the time. We show you, so we have, I never put anything in this movie, by the way, in terms of fantastic stories, unless I knew the people to whom these things happened. I didn't put third-hand accounts, whatever, such and such happened to my friend, because I was concerned, actually, about putting any of the kind of fantastic stories in, because I thought, oh, people are going to think this is nonsense. But that's true. I mean, that's the way the phenomenon is. There's a psychic thing. You think about things. All of a sudden, they're in a field. What? How did that happen? When they happen to my friends, I know it's true, And we tell several stories of things that are not quite possible that actually have happened, and, equipment failing is amongst them.
So you've made this film. I believe it came out 2009.
Came out last year.
What do you hope that people take away from it more than anything?
Well, that they really realize that something's going on. And that they don't relegate it to it's all over or it's all people, and that they really keep their minds open and become available to thinking new thoughts. And best of all would be if the establishment really investigated and really discovered that, yay, we are not making these things. Let's put it into headlines. Let's have contact in headlines. Well, that would be my dream. You want to satisfy my dreams, you put contact in headlines.
Right. Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, Suzanne, but I want to ask you this, because you talk about it on your blog, and that was the release by Reuters about the U.S. hearings. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, the media seems to be paying more attention very, very recently, actually, to the kinds of things that they've not been paying attention to before. And there was a very big press conference that a lot of the officials from the military and from government, the ex-governor of Arizona, for instance, and the ex-minister of defense from Canada, I don't know if he was on that program, but the Arizona governor was, astronauts, who have seen things that are we would think as impossible. These were UFO sort of things. They weren't crop circle things, but, we're related in that things are coming from elsewhere. And once we verify that, we are, we've really crossed the threshold. Mm-hmm. And Reuters picked that up. AOL had lots of coverage on it. The official news media were covering that press conference, which was really unheard of, because they've had things like that before, and they've been ignored. And it's like, ooh, what's going on? Maybe actually the official world is opening itself to being
or responsible reporters about what's really happening, in which event we're really going to be able to make some progress in the world taking on these new ideas.
Mm. Well, I have to tell you, is there, you know, skeptic or not, I don't know how they were made other than something out there did them. But we are at the end of our segment now, so I want to let listeners know very quickly where they can reach you.
Well, we want to send them to cropcirclemovie.com.
Okay.
And if
okay.
they go /radio, they'll get to a discount. They'll see one of the pieces of beautiful bonus material that we have on our movie.
Okay.
So go to cropcirclemovie.com/radio.
Thank you. We are out of time. I thank you, Suzanne Taylor, so much for being with us. The movie again, What on Earth? And if you missed any of that, you can check with me at Vicky at conversationslive.net, and I'll let you know where to find it. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.